I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today, we'll talk to two people who are working to fix problems in cities. The city of Flint is no stranger to economic struggle, but Flint Mayor Dane Walling is working to diversify the city's economy and change its trajectory. Today, he offers his formula for turning around a city. And we'll talk with Ben Berkowitz from the site SeeClickFix.com. Using his own experience as a citizen complaining about problems, Ben co-created a place on the web for citizens to crowdsource public alerts. Ben believes the internet can change the way we interact with municipal government, and he's proving it with SeeClickFix. All that plus the latest from PlanEdison and our CityViews commentator Walker Smith coming up after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Dane Walling was born and raised in Flint, Michigan, worked as a community organizer and aide to former D.C. Mayor Anthony Williams before being elected mayor of Flint in August, becoming one of the nation's youngest mayors. Mayor of Flint is a storied city with a great past. Tell me about Flint today.
Flint's a city that has incredible challenges that are all too well known, but we're also a city of people who are resilient and strong and proud, and we look back on that history and know that we fought through the Great Depression and came out bigger and better and stronger and helped create the middle class in this country. And I'll admit that none of us know exactly what's coming next in the city of Flint, but we are certainly not completely down and we're definitely not out.
How do you prepare people for what comes next when you don't know what comes next?
The thing that I talk the most about is diversity. And this is what we have to achieve in the city of Flint, because for the past 100 years, we've been a city that has boomed and busted with the business cycle of primarily the automotive industry, although before that it was carriages, and before that it was lumbering, and there was a day when the last tree was cut in the area. So we need to create an economy that is deliberately diverse, and that may include alternative energy and advanced technologies. It may include growing higher education and healthcare industries, there, financial services. We have the largest bank that's actually headquartered in the state of Michigan, in Citizens Bank, that's right in our downtown. The C.S. Mott Foundation, still one of the largest philanthropic institutions in the country. So we have some tremendous assets, but we have to somehow create this more deliberately diverse economy, and that's going to be the thing that will make us a sustainable place that breaks this boom-bust cycle that we've experienced, a lot like other communities, in far too much of an extreme over these past 100 years.
What do you as mayor do to make your economy more deliberately diverse?
We open our doors and we make sure we're open for business for any business idea, any business prospect, large or small or anywhere in between. I've instructed my staff to return the calls and provide complete service to anyone who wants to locate, expand into the city of Flint. And it may be university student entrepreneur who has an idea for a small downtown arcade or bike shop, or it could be someone who's looking to bring a 500 or 800 person call center to the area. We're responding to all those calls. We're following up on all those prospects because we don't know what those elements are, as we've talked about here, of that diverse 21st century Flint economy, and we then have to pursue, you know, all available paths that are open to us. Now, we're strategic, too. We're taking a look at our location quotients. We know what we have to offer some certain industries. We know we've got the space for advanced manufacturing and the workforce to go with it. We have incredible infrastructure that supports intermodal activities. Flint's halfway between Chicago and Toronto. So we're pursuing some paths very deliberately, but we're also making sure we're servicing everyone.
Do you go out and have those conversations with college students? Are you encouraging them to stay in Flint and create businesses in Flint?
We are. I'm actually working on scheduling a couple sessions now with our high school students as well as our college students, because we want them to know that the city's open for business, that we're open to their ideas and their feedback. We have a Feet on the Street program to support these small businesses downtown, a technology incubator at Kettering University, a world-class engineering school, and it's critical that these young people and young minds with fresh ideas are involved. I'm trying to show them that we have great diverse neighborhoods in the city, and we know we may not have them as residents for their lives. That's not how we all live life in the 21st century, but if we could have them for 2 or 3 years beyond graduation, or if they could be an entrepreneur in the 4 or 5 years that they're in school in Flint, then we see that as value added to our local economy.
You say you're working to make Flint a sustainable city. What do you mean by sustainable? I know you've mentioned diversity, which leads to resilience. Is that your definition of sustainability?
It's a new target for how we envision our city's future, but any city could also use this same approach, that we don't want the high growth that's followed at some point by a fast plunge. We want to have a steady, stable city that offers prosperity and opportunities for all of our residents. And that means that we have to have that core diversity. Our city has to be citizen-driven, so we're responsive to the needs that exist within the community. We're going to be going through a period of master planning next year. The city has not had a comprehensive master plan in over 30 years. We've been flying blind through this crisis. It's a terrible tragedy, and we're going to fix that next year. We'll be laying out what our land use patterns will look like in the city, provide some clearer definition of these industries that we see being likely parts of this diverse 21st century economy. One of the core land use points in this is that, unlike the old-fashioned urban, suburban, rural dichotomies, what I want to do is I want to bring as many diverse land uses in as close to proximity to each other as possible within our city municipal boundary. So I want to see dense urban style housing options in neighborhoods, along with suburban style new developments, and even some acres of experimental urban agriculture, so that our city becomes inclusive of the kind of patterns you might have seen 20 or 30 years ago across a wider metropolitan region. I think that'll make us more competitive and sustainable in the long haul.
As a mayor of a city that has its own challenges, how do you think of Flint as situated in a broader region, not just its metro area or not just in relationship, say, to Detroit or even Michigan, but rather to the Great Lakes region or the Midwest? I mean, do you spend any time thinking about that, or is that's in the future for you?
I do think about that quite a bit, because we're competing for businesses and for residents, for new investments at a whole series of different levels. We're competing against our own suburbs for central city investment. We're competing in the mid-Michigan region against Southeast Michigan, anchored by Detroit and Lansing and Ann Arbor. And then we're also competing with that wider Midwest region that you outlined, that has cities that share this similar industrial heritage, has some of the same land available and some of the same workforce available. But we're a city that is unique, and our history shows us that it's a place where the largest corporation in this world in the 20th century was founded, with General Motors. There's tremendous wealth and assets that are left over in the city of Flint. So we believe we have a special niche within that wider region. And I should say, I think there's quite a bit of room for collaborative work and collaborative thinking across that region, because when I talk about Flint being halfway between Toronto and Chicago, there's a number of other cities along that same pathway, and we need to think about how Port Huron at the Blue Water Bridge, and then Kalamazoo and Battle Creek in the western part of Michigan, how does that become a new 21st century corridor? We need to think about those cooperative relationships and not just about how we can be competitive within the region.
And of course that makes sense, those cooperative relationships, but the fact is, if I locate a business in Flint, you get the tax advantage. If I locate it outside the Flint city limits, you don't get the tax advantage. So talk to me a little bit about how you think about both competing and cooperating at the same time.
all of our cities need to highlight their distinctiveness. That's one of the things that makes this country great, that gives our residents and citizens all kinds of different choices. And the research shows that with a lot of these industries, thinking about them as clusters and networks that aren't just taking place online through the computer, we can say that some of this work can be done anywhere at any time. But the actual fact of the geography is you see clusters of economic activity in different industries. We're going to continue to be a place that has the automotive industry and the expertise there along with the rest of Southeast Michigan. And we want to build on that as a strength. And we have some opportunities in the Flint area because of the kind of talent and expertise that's available in the southern Detroit metro area. And we have to be aware of that. The other point along those lines is that we need to have this bigger sense of cooperation as we look at state and federal policy options, because even though an individual firm may choose to locate in Flint versus Dayton, Ohio, the kind of federal policy framework that's in place that shapes a business's decisions, that's something that can collectively advantage the Dayton, Ohio's and the Flint, Michigan's versus some other more ex-urban areas. And that's why I want to see urban policy that really does take this sustainability seriously and livability seriously. And I think this administration is going to do that. So as a mayor in Flint, I want to be a voice for that kind of change at the state and federal level, because that'll benefit central cities across the country.
You know, it's easy to be mayor when a city is growing and when times are good. It's difficult to be a mayor when times are not so good, not so promising. And it always seems to me that one of the challenges a mayor confronts is, how do I build a story about this place that is hopeful, that is ambitious? It's almost sleight of hand, especially when things are not as promising as perhaps your story would be, that, you know, you're trying to lead with a story that perhaps is more ambitious and more promising than today's reality. How do you balance those two things? I mean, how do you get out front with a story that makes people feel confident in Flint's future?
We have to start by being brutally realistic about these prospects and our potential, and to make sure that we do everything we can, specifically at City Hall, to take responsibility for what we can control. And that can be a source of hope. If citizens across Flint are able to see us taking responsibility for the things that we can control and seeing the day-to-day and week-to-week progress, I'm a pragmatist, and I think that people can appreciate that kind of modest day-by-day, step-by-step progress. It doesn't mean that I don't share the philosophy that we all want to be much more prosperous and we want much more justice in the world, much more equality, but how do we get from here to there? There's a practical reality in a place like Flint that it took us 30 to 40 years to get to a condition where we have unemployment rates that near what they were in the Great Depression when my grandfather graduated from Flint Central High School in 1935, but yet know that because of this boom and bust cycle that there's a point where we start to rise back up. I believe we're on that upward swing now, and we're showing the community that we can take steps every day to clear up old lawsuits, to be fiscally responsible with our tax resources, and begin to, with a brighter light than usual, highlight the great things that are happening, such as the booming enrollments of our institutions of higher education, the change taking place in some central downtown core neighborhoods, the prospect of a green Flint River corridor with the help of the Army Corps of Engineers, which has recognized that you don't have factories stacked up along that river anymore, so we can dechannel that river and make it a real community asset again. Those are things that we're going to be able to accomplish over the next few years, and that's enough inspiration for most people, given what's happened in recent decades.
Mm-hmm. You're one of the nation's youngest mayors. What cleared the way for fresh leadership in Flint?
To tell you the truth, Carol, I had to fight my way in there. I ran for mayor in 2007, and I lost a very narrow election against an incumbent who spent more money than any other mayor in the city's history. So it hasn't been an easy path, but I was committed to it. Many people around me were committed to it. We have seen some change in our city council. The average age of our 9 city councilmen is coming down with every election. I think that's a good thing, because we need this injection of fresh ideas and new energy. So the change has not come easy in a place like Flint. But in this last election, I'm proud to say I won 64% of the vote. And there was tremendous hope that people have for what we're going to be able to accomplish. It took us a long time to get to that point, but we did achieve a real public victory in that special election in August, and I believe we can build on that as we go forward through these months, and especially as we turn into the new calendar year and think fresh about what this community's future can be after we've had a few months to clean up the real mess.
Why were you successful in your second run for mayor?
The hard work really paid off. I spent countless hours knocking on thousands of doors all across the city. So that's one of the things that contributed to the success. The other was we had a very deliberate strategy of building a multiracial, multi-income, multi-whatever you want to say coalition. We had the biggest tent that you could possibly imagine. We would bring people together in their own neighborhoods to organize, in their own wards. We really activated citizens all across the city, and that's what really led to that historic victory that we had. We also used a lot of innovative technologies, and it's just a sign of the changing times that even a place like Flint, Michigan, we were using Facebook and a blog embedded on the website and an email blast. So we were able to use those new technology tools, but those were the mediums. It was the message that everyone really wanted, that it's time to work together, to set aside some of these old battles between different sides of town, between labor and management, things that are as much perception as they were reality. And we started to make those real changes through that election process. I think it's a testament to our democracy, not just in the city of Flint, but it showed that you can achieve change through the electoral process.
What advice would you have for other young would-be elected officials?
Well, the number one thing that I would say is you obviously need to develop some real compelling ideas that are appropriate for the life of your own local community. But the other thing you have to do, that's the creative and the analytical part of it. But you also have to learn how to campaign. And you have to learn how to earn the votes, because at the end of the day, that's what gets counted on election day. I don't believe personally in running for a cause. If you want to promote a cause, start a nonprofit organization. If you get in a political campaign, you're in it to win it, and that's what your supporters expect of you. I worked my first campaign in 1998 for my congressman, Dale Kildee, and I started, like a lot of people do, passing out literature and making volunteer calls and banging up the big posts for the big yard signs. So you have to understand the system that you're trying to change, and in the case of election, you have to understand how to go out and get the votes.
Who do you need to govern well in Flint? Who has to share your agenda?
It's this coalition, and we've accomplished a clear relationship with our citizens, and we're nurturing that through a series of neighborhood action sessions, first in every ward, and then we'll go deeper in the winter in each of the neighborhoods. But we also are spending a lot of time building relationships with our business community and with our philanthropic community. There's no city in this country that has turned around without a strong public-private partnership. And that's not something that you achieve during an electoral campaign, in my view. Electoral campaign, you're talking about citizens. Some of those business owners and investors may or may not be the ones who actually get to vote in the election. And money's a factor, but it's not the deciding one, it's the votes. So I'm spending a lot of time now with our chambers of commerce, our small business associations, and business owners one-on-one, getting to know their needs and learning what we can do as a city to work in genuine partnership. And the same goes with our colleges and universities and hospitals and major institutions. So we're trying to broaden that coalition, make it as inclusive as possible. That's where we're going to be able to really leverage and multiply the efforts that each of us can put forward. And hey, we have to admit, what we're trying to do here is beat the odds. A place like Flint, Michigan, odds are that we're going to be a little bit worse off tomorrow than we are today. That's what the trajectory of history would be. And we're trying to change that. And the way you do it is you leverage and you multiply efforts. So you need citizens and businesses and the other major institutions all in alignment and going in the same direction.
What will you need? Do you have a four-year term?
It's a four-year term by charter. I was elected in a special election in August, so I have about 2.5 years and will be up for election in August and November of 2011.
Wow, not much time. So what do you need to accomplish by August and November 2011 to feel like your first term as mayor was a success?
Well, number one, we have to keep the budget balanced, because in these toughest of times, it's an unfortunate fact that we're having to make monthly payments on the budget deficit that was run up in 2002. We're making payments on that bond that was created through an emergency receiver when the state took the city over. We're also making payments on the last elected mayor's deficit from the fiscal year 2008. So we cannot go down the road of deficits again. We have to stay balanced, and staying balanced means making those payments on those previous deficits. We also need to show the community that we're taking serious and bold steps around public safety. It's something we haven't talked a lot about here, but I hear it from residents every single day. We're reforming our police department to make it all community policing. I've made a commitment that we'll have a police neighborhood mini station in every ward. We have 9 wards in the city. There had been 3 or 4 operating when I took office, so we're trying to deliver on that promise even here in my first 100 days. And then we're also going to have to show some leadership with our school system and around education, because in the 21st century, everyone needs more education than they have today, and that goes from to high school dropouts on up through people with masters. If you've got one master's, you got to start working on your second one. So the community is really looking to me to put together a task force with our superintendent and to do some work with our colleges and universities to make sure that there's even greater educational opportunities available for our citizens, but also that there's greater excellence and greater accomplishment for those going through those systems.
So what could stop you? What is going to get in your way that will make you not achieve the success that you want to achieve?
The financial resources are a big part of this, and it's ironic that you asked me this question, because I often tell people that I would never use financial resources as an excuse, because we have to find a way to deliver services regardless of the circumstances. But I have to admit that in the back of my mind, I know that there comes a point, if there's not some larger state and federal reform, especially around health care and retirement benefits and what our local units of government are asked to bear, that if we have a shrinking tax base, we're going to get to a point in a couple years where more than 50 cents out of every dollar in the door goes to pay for legacy costs. And then you pile on top of that 20% more of your budget going to pay off previous deficits. And you can envision an impossible financial scenario. So we need some federal health care reform. We need our state to look seriously at these municipal and other public pension funds and how that liability can be better apportioned out. So those are some of the things that do rack my brain, and I'm looking to create the partnerships and bring in the dollars so we can stay away from that line where we move into the red and create an impossible situation for ourselves. So far in these first couple months, we've been able to keep our head above water.
Do you think that you are going to be able to see a way through to creating a different sort of pension situation going forward? I mean, it's the thing every mayor complains about, and yet it's the thing that every mayor, I mean, it's a result of the negotiations that some mayor before you had, right? I mean, it was the former mayor in every city that, in effect, gave away the store and negotiated pension benefits that, I mean, it was highly predictable what would happen, right? This is not a surprise.
Right, especially if you reject the assumption that you have ever-increasing growth.
Right.
And that's where we have to have a different mindset, not of how we make decisions today that incur future costs, but how do we make decisions today that limit future costs. So when we're looking at our parks and green space, and one of our metrics is how do we every year have fewer acres to mow than we had the year before. So we have to take some steps each year to make a few more areas naturalized, make them passive green spaces instead of active. And we need to do that in every part of our spending to make sure that our decisions aren't postponing costs, but are actually limiting costs. And I'm looking forward after that re-election in 2011 to get real serious about the pensions and about the legacy costs. And it's not going to be to limit benefits to folks who deserve them, but to find the appropriate way to pay for those services.
Mayor, it's been a pleasure talking with you. I appreciate so much the leadership you're showing in Flint. I think it gives us all inspiration for what we can do in our cities. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thank you, Carol. It's a pleasure to talk with you, and people can get to me anytime at mayor@cityofflint.com.
Dane Walling is mayor of Flint, Michigan. And now for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
Aging infrastructure can be a messy problem. Calamities like the collapse of the I-35 bridge in Minneapolis in August 2007 highlight the trouble and human toll that can come from neglected infrastructure. But beyond such devastating anomalies, day-to-day infrastructure problems are plaguing America, especially as we get into the rainy season. An investigation from the New York Times looked into the country's aging sewer infrastructure and found that growing populations and rainfall often combine to overwhelm sewage facilities. As a result, partially treated or completely untreated human waste overflows into the nation's waterways and lakes. An examination of reports from the Environmental Protection Agency showed that more than one-third of the nation's 25,000 sewer systems have experienced these overflows in the last 3 years. It's a stinky problem that violates the Clean Water Act and endangers many Americans by polluting drinking water sources. And as cities continue to grow, the problems stemming from this outdated infrastructure, some of it more than 100 years old, are likely to grow. But some places might not have to worry about populations stressing their aging infrastructure. A recent article from USA Today shows that America's booming suburbs are starting to slow down their pace of expansion. Some are even losing population. 53 of America's cities with populations over 100,000 had been growing at double-digit rates over the last two decades. But over the last 2 years, more than half of those cities have actually lost population. The age of the boomburbs may be coming to an end. And it seems that the real estate bubble is mostly to blame. Most of the cities that had experienced those high levels of growth only to plummet in the last 2 years are the same cities that had relied almost entirely on the real estate boom to fuel their economies. So now these declining cities are going to have to shift gears from rapidly growing juggernauts to more modest, and some might even say shrinking, smaller cities. And finally, it was once the nation's biggest and most expensive public works project, and after years of delays and troubles, the Big Dig could finally be coming to a close. They said it was finished 2 years ago, but as the Boston Globe reports, the state has yet to create footbridges and links between the new parks the project created. But now, with $30 million in federal stimulus money in their pockets, state environmental officials have opened construction bids on the first of three planned footbridges between the new park spaces. Leftover stimulus money will be combined with other sources to finish the other bridges in the coming years, finally bringing to a close one of the most drawn-out public projects in American history. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen. Coming up after the break, Ben Berkowitz, co-founder of SeeClickFix.com, will tell us about a new way to report problems in your neighborhood and track them until they're fixed. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Ben Berkowitz had his inspiration for SeeClickFix when he got tired of waiting on hold with the city of New Haven, Connecticut, to report a problem. Why wait on hold when you can report a problem anytime, anywhere, and track it until it's fixed? That's the power of SeeClickFix. Ben, describe the concept behind SeeClickFix.
So SeeClickFix, at its most basic level, is a tool to report non-emergency issues like potholes or graffiti to those accountable for the public space, government officials, or just your local citizen that wants to fix something up.
Where is SeeClickFix being used?
It started in New Haven, Connecticut. It's being heavily used here, but it's being used as far away as Joondalup, Australia. SeeClickFix can be picked up and used anywhere in the world right now where English is spoken, because all it takes is for a user to document an issue and then for another user to have set up what we call a watch area to send alerts about that issue to public officials.
Now, explain that a little more. For instance, let's say I'm in Chicago. I want to use SeeClickFix. So what if my public officials, how do I know that my complaint, what I've seen, is going to get to my public official?
Sure. So when you click on the map, it will tell you if there is someone watching nearby. And if there is someone watching nearby, when you report the issue, an email will be sent to them telling them that the pothole has been reported and that the issue is publicly documented and open on SeeClickFix. If a watch area has not been created for a public official or someone else in Chicago, you can go to the city website or call the city and ask for the email of, say, Department of Public Works. And then you can go to SeeClickFix, you can type in Chicago, you can then type in who's watching, and you can click create a watch area. and actually draw the geographic boundaries if they're not already defined for Chicago and attach an email. Then you hit submit, and all issues reported thereafter will be sent as email to that public official.
I see. So in other words, I have taken the step as someone, for instance, who wants to report a problem. If there is no watch area, there's no one watching my area, then I can be proactive, go get an email, and then hope that that email is read, right?
That's right. Yeah, exactly. It's crowdsourced alerting.
Uh-huh. So how does it work? I mean, how is it working? In other words, particularly in places where, let's say, public officials have been volunteered into the system, haven't asked you to set up a watch area or haven't done it themselves, but in fact have been volunteered by citizens. Have you had experience there? Do you know how it's working?
Yeah, I actually think that about 50% of the watchers on C-Click Fix have been volunteered by their constituents. And it surprised me initially, but now I've come to expect it. And the typical response is that they generally just communicate back on the platform with the citizen. So in the case of Minneapolis 311, someone created a watch area for them. And when issues are reported to them, they come back with a service request number, or if they can't give a service request number, they'll, because it's not within their purview, then they'll let you know.
Generally speaking, does C-Click Fix feed existing city data systems, or is that, I mean, obviously you're feeding an email in the case you cited, but in some cases you're feeding the 411 system, aren't you? Or the system of that cities have already to report complaints.
Right. So our basic, as Nick Grossman from the Open Planning Project says, our basic API is email. API meaning the connection to governments. But we're very involved in the open data movement right now, which says that governments should open up much of their municipal data, things like the 311 data that you're talking about and the type of data that most of our reports fall into, meaning that when they open it up, their data will be machine readable and systems like C-Click Fix will be able to display that data. And then also systems like C-Click Fix will be able to feed the database with issues like potholes. So we are working to help try to standardize a connection between these 311 systems and outside systems like C-Click Fix. The advantages to governments are things like really cool iPhone apps that allow citizens to document issues with a photo and their location. Dig-like voting systems that allows communities to vote on issues. And then all of those neat social features for citizens tied directly into a format that's manageable for government, into systems that their employees are already trained on, made by companies like Motorola, Oracle, Lagen is another one. These are the companies that design the 311 systems.
Are cities eager to have problems reported to them, particularly now when they're under such budget pressures?
We definitely see cities that are hesitant to get more data, but I think what we've learned is that cities pay people to go out and find these issues. We have city inspectors. A lot of these issues are liabilities. They are not only real liabilities, but they're political liabilities as well, to have these things festering in a community that upset people. To not have them addressed is, I think, most good people in government know that to not have them addressed is worse than to have them documented. So I think generally a positive response.
What was your impulse that led you to create C-Click Fix?
I was sitting on hold with my local government trying to figure out how to get graffiti off the neighbor's building next door. And I started thinking that there probably wasn't enough accountability in the phone system I was using. And I also started thinking that my neighbors probably wanted the issue fixed as well, but there was no way to collectively send that knowledge to government. And so sat down with friends who are now co-founders on a weekend on a Sunday night and said, let's see if we can we can build something like this on the internet that would allow us to collectively display our desire to resolve issues in the public space.
I love that. I love that founder story. Let me ask you this, Ben. You and I both are aware of the very famous story of voting and crowdsourcing of issues that happened after President Obama was elected and before he took office. And there was this movement driven by the Obama campaign to identify issues that the president should address. And as I recall, the number one issue that the crowd decided that President Obama should address when he got to office was the legalization of marijuana. And I think everyone thought, please, we've got a few bigger fish to fry than that. So, you know, that seems to me like a flaw in this notion of crowdsourcing for political or for public policy purposes. What's your take on that?
You know, I think what's really crucial here is the fact that, I guess using marijuana as an example, what's really important about that is not necessarily what they were voting on or what they were speaking up about, but the fact that they were speaking up at all. I think the most important thing with tools like CClickFix and the open data movement in general and open government is that we're really trying to encourage people to get more involved in government. And that may not mean getting your way every time or that the popular vote is always the best thing for the country. But if people are willing and feel comfortable to speak up and have a platform to speak up about the fact that they, say, want marijuana legalized, then that in itself is really a win for our country.
Well, I get it at one level, and participation may be good, but from a politician's standpoint, if I have to get reelected, then the thing I want to do really is serve the needs of the most people who are going to go to the polls and vote. And, you know, in this case, I think it's pretty clear that if the Obama administration had acted on that as their first priority, then, you know, people would have thought he was pretty wacky. So I guess part of the issue is, does that sort of voting and crowdsourcing represent only a certain demographic or a minority of people that, you know, one needs to be pretty cautious when listening to the voice of the net?
Sure. I think we're at a crossroads right now where the internet, my guess would be that the internet is ubiquitous enough in the United States that we've enabled more people to take action and to speak up than less, only because I think time is more the issue in this country. I think, you know, the majority of people can't show up to a community meeting or maybe even show up to vote. And, you know, with a communication source that allows you to speak up at 12 o'clock at night after the kids are in bed and you're done with your second day job, we've enabled more people to get involved in the process than less.
Well, I think certainly that is true, and I completely agree with you that time is this very precious resource to most of us today, and so it is a challenge to, I think, formats like public meetings have really lost their value in many ways. On the other hand, taking action to report a problem, in effect complain, is one form of citizenship, but it's certainly, you and I would both readily agree, I'm sure, that it's not enough. So help me think about the other tools that are out there, Ben, that people that would allow people to go the next step, to organize, or perhaps even fix the problem themselves. I mean, what do you see for the future of this movement of open data and more than that, really, citizen engagement?
Sure. I think the idea that our system exists even as a third party and that it's not a government-controlled system is a step in the right direction. That makes people think that maybe I can take responsibility myself and resolve an issue on my own. You know, maybe I can clean up the park or remove the graffiti. So when it comes to our system, I think participation goes both ways. It's not just reporting in, but also resolving issues for your neighborhood, for yourself, and for your community. In terms of other tools and platforms that I'd like to see, I'd go back to the public meeting issue and say that getting more public meetings online in video and then enabling people to interact with them in a social social media fashion would be something that would be really advantageous, so we can get more opinions in those rooms that were typically controlled by maybe the four most vocal people in a neighborhood representing, you know, a few thousand. So that's something I'd really like to say.
Mm-hmm. And is the technology available to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've talked to people that are interested in doing that and then have gotten, you know, part of the way. And I think we'll be seeing things like that soon. I think especially as mobile video becomes more accessible and more ubiquitous, we'll find more people taking notes via video and then putting those into the digital space. I got the new iPhone a couple weeks ago, and having the video player on there, just being able to tweet a video in a couple minutes, really changes things.
Mm-hmm. It does, doesn't it? What would keep a city from adopting CClickFix? I mean, why would a city not want to do it?
Initially, we saw, I think, some concern over the transparency, the public documentation of the issues. But that, I think, starts to go away as people in government realize that letting citizens know what's going on and what they're really up against, that they have thousands of potholes that they haven't filled and that there's not enough tax dollars to fill them, is better than not knowing. So I think we've overcome that hurdle. I do think that the federal government's policy on transparency and some of the messages they're disseminating are definitely trickling down to the municipal level and affecting the way our leaders think about openness at the local level. One argument we hear occasionally is we already have a 311 system, or we already have a means for citizens to communicate with us. And our response to that, which is generally taken favorably, is that you do have a means for that, but that system is controlled by you and it's only for issues for government. And it essentially is also saying that only government can fix those issues. Our argument is that in regards to the public space, municipal government is responsible, state government is responsible, utilities companies are responsible, nonprofits are responsible, citizen groups and community groups are responsible. There's all these organizations that are really entitled to the public space and empowered to fix it. And this is a way to take that weight a little bit off of government's back and put it back into the hands of everybody else that's taken responsibility.
Interesting. You know, in many communities, I don't know that it's all, but certainly in many communities, the sidewalks out in front of a building are the property owner's responsibility, not the government's responsibility. So I suppose property owners would fit into that responsible party category as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I always forget to mention businesses and personal ownership, but there's a ton of things that we do in regards to zoning as property owners, or in terms of business or university, in terms of the public transportation we put on the street that affects the general public. And we see all types of issues that are related directly to holding another individual accountable or a business accountable. I noticed yesterday in Philadelphia, there's a trucking company that neighbors are really frustrated with, I think mostly over the idling of their vehicles in their neighborhood for long periods of time, and they've had a ton of trouble relaying to the company to stop, and they're using CClickFix to have that conversation. There's a nonprofit called the Clean Air Council that's helping them advocate for getting these types of companies to change their policy around letting their drivers idle their vehicles. And I also noticed that when you search this company's name in Google, the CClickFix issue about their idling vehicles comes up as number one.
Oh, interesting. That should get the company's attention.
My guess is it would. People spend a ton of money to have people say good things about their company on the first page of Google. So when you can't get rid of the bad things, I guess you just address them. I would assume that's what I would do.
Let me come back to your point about the open data movement at the federal level and with this administration and the way it's trickling down and influencing local governments. Who do you see as being ahead of the curve on this at a local level? Are there governments that are doing a particularly good job now of opening their data to let people like you build applications on top of that data?
Yeah, San Francisco, D.C., New York are all the cities that have Toronto that have open data movements and are having competitions to build applications that connect with the data that they've opened up. For us, though, our kind of hero cities are more cities like Philadelphia, where they're willing to accept data from parties that they have less control over, and where it's less of a policy and more of just a practical way to communicate with citizens. So Philadelphia has been really great about responding to the issues that we send to them, or that CClickFix sends to them on behalf of their citizens. And one thing that's really interesting is that I think not only are governments are skeptical about the idea that these kind of systems can really work and be beneficial, but occasionally we see that citizens are a little skeptical as well. I was reading a blog in Philadelphia yesterday, and they were talking about an issue on CClickFix where a citizen had reported, and Philadelphia 311, using their logo and the name Philadelphia 311, had responded. And the citizen in this bulletin board had said, "Is that really Philly 311? That's really cool if it is." And it was like they were still skeptical that their government actually might be communicating with them transparently. Like the more likely situation might be that someone might actually impersonate their government to communicate with them. So this is what we're up against, but it seems to be going the right direction. And I think, there's tons of cities like Philadelphia on CClickFix. The city of New Haven is where we live, has been great about it. Everyone from the police department to traffic and parking uses the system to respond to citizens.
Did you have to reach out to them personally to get them to do that, or what made them particularly enthusiastic in Philly and particularly in New Haven?
In New Haven, I definitely reached out to some people. In Philadelphia, they just started responding, though. And that's the case with most of the cities. I actually feel like sometimes when I start having conversations, I get in the way of the way the tool works, and that it works better when I'm not involved in the conversation, or when someone from CClickFix is not involved in the conversation. I think as a third party, the best thing you can do is stay out of the way and let constituents communicate with governments without your help. We certainly will jump in on a comment string when a government responds back and says something like, "Not our responsibility, this is state responsibility." And that's kind of the place where we'll say, "This is the way the tool is built. Why don't you create a watch area for the state and hold them accountable as well?" So we do try to put in pointers as to the things we've built and guide people, show people how to use them.
Well, we've enjoyed talking with you, Ben. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City today.
Thanks for having me, Carol.
Ben Berkowitz is the co-founder of CClickFix.com. Finally this week, our City Views commentator has hit a little turbulence. Walker Smith shares with us a little consumer report on how companies can keep customers.
I trudged to the Atlanta airport one day last week for a 6 a.m. flight to Minneapolis. When I walked in, the departure board said my flight was leaving from gate E34. This was an unusual gate for a Delta flight, most of which leave from terminals A or B for major cities like Minneapolis. Plus, E is the international terminal. But more and more, Delta has been using E gates for domestic flights, so I made my way through security and headed for the train to get to Terminal E. But before I got on the train, I checked another departure board. Same gate, E34. Now, there is only one gate farther away from security in the Atlanta airport than E34, and that's E36 right beside it. E is the last terminal stop on the train, and the wing of the E concourse with E34 is the longest of the three wings on E. Needless to say, E34 is at the very end of that long concourse. When I got to E, I checked the departure board one more time just to make sure before I walked all the way down to E34. It was still showing that gate. As I was making my way down the concourse, I saw an older man and a young boy ahead of me. At one point, he slipped and fell, but got right back up and kept going. As it turned out, the two of them were making slow progress toward my gate, E34. When I got there, though, the gate was dark. No agent, no plane, even though Minneapolis was shown on the board behind the counter. At this point, It was 20 minutes to departure, and I knew that this was not the right gate. But it was 5:40 a.m., and there was no one around to ask. So I started dialing the Delta 800 number when I heard someone way back down the concourse yell, B-13. I don't know how this person knew that, because all the departure boards still read E-34, but the dozen or so of us there picked up our stuff and started to hustle. It was a long walk back, and I noticed as I got on the train from E to B that the older man and the young boy, who was his grandson, it turned out, were lagging way behind. In fact, other people had run on ahead of me, so I was lagging myself. When I got to B-13, I told the agent that an older man and his grandson were coming on the next train, and could he be sure to wait for them before closing the door? At which point, he yelled at me, "I've said 25 times already that I know there are people coming." I just turned and walked down the jetway. Almost right behind me came the gate agent with the final paperwork. I turned to a flight attendant as I was getting on the plane and explained about the wrong gate being posted and the older man and his grandson. She just shrugged, said there was nothing she could do, and turned away. I looked at another flight attendant. Same response. So I dropped my stuff in the aisle and walked back up to the cockpit and barged in on the pilots to tell them the same thing. The gate agent, now in the jetway, ready to close the door, told me to get back in my seat. To their credit, the pilots got up and went out to see about these other passengers, and within a few minutes arrived five more people, including the older man and his grandson. This situation made me mad, so I complained to Delta in some detail. What did I get? Well, 2,500 frequent flyer miles in my SkyMiles account. It's almost as if Delta has a budget to buy complainers off rather than apologize and address the problem. Which brings me to my point. Researchers at the Nottingham School for Economics in the UK have found that customers who had a bad experience with a company were twice as likely to forgive a company if they were offered an apology instead of cash. This means that the cost to a company of not simply saying, "I'm sorry," is more than the cash offered. It's the lost loyalty and goodwill of customers who remain unforgiving. That's certainly the case with me, although living in Atlanta, it's not likely that I'll be flying Delta any less. Instead, I'll just be telling stories like this to people like you who may have a choice. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. There's more Smart City for you online. Go to smartcityradio.com to download past shows. Sign up for our newsletter and get links to our guest work. You can subscribe to our podcast and have Smart City delivered straight to you. You can also get in touch with us, click on the contact button, or send email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. I'm Carol Coletta.